It's very nice to be almost back with you. I spoke to the Albuquerque Sangha a couple of times when I was teaching in Santa Fe. And yeah, I was impressed. I would love to be doing this in person. Yeah. Oh well. But I see people that I know from before, and it's nice to see familiar faces, and that's great. But I do want to do one thing first. Let me get this going right here. You're about to put something in the chat. I'll hold off on that because, come on. Share screen. Can you fix it so I can share my screen?
You should be able to share your screen. I made you a co-host.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Okay. It shared the wrong screen. It does this a lot. Right. Stop share. Could you see the bowl? Let me try it again. Okay, can you see the bowl?
Yes.
Okay, can you see what it says? Sthana for Lee can be made directly. And I cross that out because I want you to give your dana to some worthy cause that makes the world a better place. I was a computer programmer. I did okay. I got a nest egg. I got nice social security. The world is in a mess these days. And giving me a little bit more money is probably not going to help that much to make the world less of a mess. You have the opportunity to do something really useful. So, what I want you to do is find some worthy cause. It could be political. I happen to know that in New Mexico, the second congressional districts in a very tight race. That might be a worthy cause. It could be some other political thing. If you want to give money to help the refugees from Ukraine, that would be very worthy. If you want to give money to help overcome global warming, that would be extremely worthy. So, yeah, if you send me some money, it's nice, but I think you can actually use your dana more profitably to find somebody that you think is doing a good job to make the world a better place, some organization, some person, and send your dana there. Okay? This is my dana now that I'm doing for the world, and it only works if you can do that for me. So, yeah, you don't need to put anything on the chat. Everybody gets to find their own worthy cause. And of course, if you're finding a worthy cause, yeah, maybe you can even support it a few more times other than just right now. Okay. So I understand you start with a meditation for a half an hour, and so it's 30 minutes, 37 minutes past the hour. So we're going to do mindfulness of breathing. Everyone check to make sure that you are muted. I see a couple people who are not muted. And I'm going to give basic instructions for mindfulness of breathing. If you want to do some other meditation, you can ignore me. But basically, get yourself settled into a nice, upright posture that's reasonably comfortable. More important to be comfortable than look good. And close your eyes and put your attention on your breathing. Just notice the tactile sensations of breathing. It can be at the nose. You're noticing the air coming in a little cool and going out a little warm. Maybe it's the rise and fall of your belly or the rise and fall of your chest that you're noticing. Doesn't matter. but you're just to notice the natural breath. This is about observation, not controlling anything. Now, when you become distracted, it's not a big deal. The best thing to do is simply label your distraction, planning, worrying, wanting, angry, nonsense. The first word that comes to mind is always correct. Spend zero energy trying to get the perfect label. You get it perfect most of the time. And then, very important, relax and bring your attention back to the sensations of breathing. The attitude you want to have is one of relaxed diligence. Not trying to force anything. You're not trying to force your attention on your breathing. You're resting in the sensations of breathing. And you're diligent about noticing when you become distracted. Label, relax, come back. So, the jhanas, the J word. The jhanas are eight altered states of consciousness that are brought on by concentration, and each yields even more concentration. This allows you to stair-step your way to deeper and deeper levels of concentration. Concentration is a translation of the Pali word samadhi. Not bad, but I prefer to translate it as indistractability. When you concentrate on something, you're working at it fully and not becoming distracted. So, yeah, what we're trying to do is build our ability to not become distracted. The reason for doing that is that, well, what we really want is wisdom. We want to understand what's actually happening. If we understand what's actually happening, we can operate in harmony with what's actually happening rather than at cross purposes. Operating in harmony with what's actually happening means less dukkha. And the Buddha said that all he taught was dukkha and the end of dukkha. So, in order to understand what's really happening, we need to do an insight practice, a vipassana practice. But to do it most effectively, we need to do it with a well-concentrated mind. And the method for obtaining a well-concentrated mind, what the Buddha called right concentration, is to move through these eight altered states of consciousness. Basically, the jhanas are a warm-up exercise for your insight practice. You know, in the Olympics, they don't give you any medals for, you know, stretching your calf or being able to touch your toes, right? You've got to actually run the race and finish first to get the medal. Well, in the Buddha's dispensation, you've got to come to understand how the world actually works. We're needing to examine in terms of, well, anicca, dukkha, anatta, the impermanent, inconstant nature of things. The fact that nothing is going to give you lasting happiness. It's all, yeah, changing and unsatisfactory. And, well, my best translation of dukkha would be bummer. You know, bummers happen. And anatta. Not self, or literally not self, but it means coreless or empty. No essence can be found. And so what we want to do is investigate reality and see the truths of these in a really deep way so that it basically transforms how we relate to reality. And it's much better to do it with a well-concentrated mind. And the jhanas are what the Buddha recommended. So the instructions I gave you for mindfulness of breathing are a way to begin jhana practice. Sit down, get comfortable, put your attention on your meditation object, the breath being a very useful object. You could also use metta, you could use a body scan, you could use a mantra, lots of ways to generate access concentration, sufficient concentration to give you access to the jhanas. But let's say it's with the breath, okay? So you put your attention on your breathing, and most likely sooner or later, your attention wanders off. It's not a big deal. You just notice it wandered off. That's a victory, okay? Label the distraction, relax, come back. Now, if the act of labeling is bigger than the distraction, you don't need to label, okay? But if you just spent 5 months in Hawaii, I mean, 5 minutes in Hawaii, yeah. You need to label planning or remembering or whatever it is. And yeah, relax and come back. That relax is really good because pretty much any distraction is going to produce a little bit of tension. Our distractions generally match up with the hindrances. Everybody remember the five hindrances? Wanting, not wanting, too little energy, too much energy, and doubt. It's usually given as sensual desire, ill will and anger, restlessness and sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. But yeah, if you get caught in wanting, there's a little tension there about wanting. Okay, relax. You get some aversion going. Yeah, there's definitely tension there. Relax. You know, after you label, just relax. Keep coming back to your object. Forcing your attention to remain on your object is counterproductive. It will drive you nuts. It just won't work. I mean, maybe you can do it, but I've actually had several students who tried to do that and wound up leaving the retreat because they had driven themselves nuts trying to do it. This whole thing needs to be done with a really relaxed attitude, relaxed diligence. And eventually, if you just keep coming back, your mind will settle. Maybe not in 30 minutes. You might need to go on a retreat, and it takes 4 or 5 days for you to get really settled, but okay, that's what's necessary. Once you get to the point where you're not becoming distracted, any thoughts are wisping in the background and not pulling you off into distraction. You're knowing each in-breath, you're knowing each out-breath. That's what I call access concentration. You want to let the access concentration build. It's not like you followed 3 breaths in a row. You know, stick with it. Give it 5 or 10 minutes. Just, you know, really there, not being distracted. And then if you want to enter the first jhana, there's a trick. And that's to let go of whatever object you were using to get to access concentration and focus on a pleasant sensation. You might be wondering, what pleasant sensation? Well, you notice the Buddha statues all have that little smile. It's not just for artistic purposes. If you smile when you meditate, even if it's a fake smile, by the time you get to access concentration, it will feel more genuine. And you can shift your attention from your breath 1 inch to the smile, assuming you're noticing the breath at the nostrils. Smiling is pleasant. Smiling generates endorphins. Endorphins make you feel good. Feeling good is pleasant, right? So now you focus on the smile. Or, actually, the smile only works for about 25% of the students I work with. So, yeah, maybe the hands. A lot of students report a warm, tingly glow in their hands once they're at access for a while. Focus on the pleasantness of that warm, tingly glow. Or maybe it's in your third eye, or the top of your head, top of your shoulders, soles of your feet. You name a body part. I've had some student find pleasure in that body part and able to focus on it. And then comes the really difficult part. Do nothing else. Yeah, we want to do something. Well, it's no, just enjoy the pleasantness of the pleasant sensation without becoming distracted. If you can do that, eventually it will start increasing in intensity, slowly at first, and then suddenly it'll just take off and transport you into an obviously altered state of consciousness full of, well, the Pali words are piti and sukha. Piti gets translated as rapture, euphoria, ecstasy, delight, interest. My favorite translation is glee. It's a energetic, pleasant release of energy. And sukha, the opposite of dukkha, is joy, happiness. And so you're transported by focusing on a pleasant sensation undistractedly into an altered state full of glee and happiness, rapture and joy, however you want to translate it. But it's a pretty interesting state. It's fairly unmistakable when it arrives. It's really kind of different from, yeah, where you normally hang out. I call it the first jhana if you've got the piti and the sukha, and it sustains, and you can sustain your attention on it. That's what it takes to make it the first jhana. All right, so you stay there for a while. If it's really intense, maybe you don't stay very long. It can be so intense, it's like sticking your finger in the electrical socket. Or it could be kind of mild. Yeah, you're just, yeah, having a good time. It's really nice, really sweet. If it's really strong, yeah, maybe you move on fairly quickly. If it's mild, you might stay there 5 minutes. I wouldn't stay more than 10 minutes. But yeah, it's a definitely altered state. When you've had enough, the trick to moving on to the second jhana is take a deep breath and really let the energy out. That will calm the PT. What you're doing is a foreground-background shift. In the first jhana, the PT predominates, the glee, and the happiness is in the background. And now you take a deep breath, let the energy out, the glee will calm down, and you can focus on the sukha, the joy, happiness. And now that becomes your object for the second jhana. The PT may not disappear completely, it may be in the background. Instead of a lot of energy, maybe you find yourself rocking or swaying or making circles or something like that. You're not still. In other words, there's still some energy there, but it's much calmer. And you're focused on the sense of happiness. When the happiness is intense, it can be like somebody gave you a really nice birthday present and you open it up and it's like, oh, I always wanted one of these. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it can be happiness like that. But it's not triggered by something external. It's triggered by your concentrated mind. Ayakema said, we don't put these jhanas in here. They're already in there. What we need to do is stop covering them up. And so by getting really concentrated and turning your attention in the direction of pleasure, you're basically uncovering what's naturally there underneath. But we cover it up with our busyness and our worries and our all the stuff we're doing. But if you get quiet enough, the gleeful mind shows forth, and then you can take a deep breath and calm it down to a nice happy mind. Hang out there from the second jhana on. You could hang out as long as you wanted. Probably 10 minutes is going to be enough. If you want to move on towards the third jhana, take another deep breath, let the energy out. And what you're aiming at now is contentment, satisfaction, wishlessness. You're aiming for a state of satisfaction so complete that if Mick Jagger were practicing the third jhana, you wouldn't be able to sing that song. Okay, you are satisfied. And again, it's a matter of lowering the energy level. It may be helpful as you take that deep breath and let the energy out to remember an incident when you were very contented. I don't know, you just ate the perfect meal, you didn't overeat, and you don't have to wash the dishes, right? A quarter second memory of the feeling of contentment, and then focus your attention on that feeling. When you do so, all of the PT, all of the energy should go away, and you should now find yourself in a very still place, a contented stillness. That's what the third jhana is about. And you're just focused on that contented stillness. Again, stay for a while, and then after 10 minutes or so, you want to move on. Take another deep breath and let all the pleasure go. Being contented is pleasant. I mean, it's a nice feeling. All right. Can you find the pleasure? For me, I got a little wispy Buddha smile. First jhana, I got a big smile. You can see my teeth. Second jhana, big smile, no teeth. Third jhana, wispy Buddha smile. All I have to do is take the breath, and as I let the energy out, just really relax all the muscles in my face. When I do, there's a sense of dropping down. I just drop down towards a place of quiet stillness. The fourth jhana is described often as a state of equanimity. But I tell you to focus on equanimity, maybe that's a little hard to do. But if I tell you focus on quiet stillness, you will be focused on equanimity. And so you're just sitting there, nothing much going on except that you're focused on quiet stillness. The Buddha says this is a state beyond pleasure and pain, and it's got mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. You've put your mind in a state where your mindfulness is going to be at its peak. And mindfulness is what we want to do our insight practice. We want mindfulness that's indistractable. So you've sat down, got yourself comfortable, put your attention on your meditation object, come back from the distractions, eventually settled into the meditation object, gotten to access concentration, focused on some pleasant. Now at that point, you got to let go of the breath or your metta or whatever you're doing. You need to be well concentrated because the pleasant sensation is a more subtle object than the breath or metta or anything else. So that's why you got to get to access concentration. And now you focus on that pleasant sensation and enjoy it, and you're setting up a positive feedback loop. You know, positive feedback loop? Like, if this was a microphone and I held it up to the speaker, it'd make a horrible noise. The ambient noise in the room is going into the microphone, getting amplified, coming out louder, getting amplified some more, coming out louder again, right? That's a positive feedback loop, except you're trying to do that with pleasure. Your mind is so steady that when you focus on the pleasure, it doesn't wobble, and it's pleasant to be focused on pleasure, which adds a little more pleasure. Well, adding a little more pleasure, that's also pleasant, which adds a, all right, you get the picture, until it erupts into piti and sukha. The piti and sukha can get to be too much. You take a breath, calm it down. Now you've got sukha with a little background piti, you're happy. You've managed to generate happiness independent of external circumstances. The present that your friend gives you that makes you happy has an external circumstance. But now you've just got your concentrated mind. The neurological pathway of happiness is in there. You normally need an external stimulus to make it happen. But now you've found a way that you can make it happen just with your concentrated mind. That's a useful thing to have. Calm it down further to contentment, to wishlessness, and further still to quiet stillness. And then you have a mind that's concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, which you can direct and incline towards knowing and seeing. Knowing and seeing what? Well, the Buddha says, one should see, this is my body, made of material form, composed of the four great elements, born of mother and father, fed on rice and gruel, impermanent, subject to rubbing and pressing, to dissolution and dispersion. And this is my consciousness, which is bound up with it and supported by it. The jhanas give you the mind that's going to make your insight practice go the best. Now, if you're familiar with the Satipatthana suttas, the suttas that discuss the four foundations of mindfulness, or maybe a little more accurately, the four establishments of mindfulness, these are four arenas that you should investigate. The first one, body. Yeah, that's what the Buddha said, right? This is my body, made of the four elements, etc. The second one is Vedana. Vedana is your initial categorization of a sensory input, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. This happens in your old brain, the reptilian structure, so-called. It's not under your control, but the Vedana run our lives. They're either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And we go running after the pleasant, running away from the unpleasant, and ignore the neutral. And the Buddha says, pay attention to that. Don't let the Vedana run your life. Enjoy the pleasant. Deal with the unpleasant, but don't ignore the neutral. Really see what's going on and how you're reacting to it. That's the second. The third, Vedana, yeah, it's happening in the mind, right? Third, mind states. Yeah, are you happy, sad, confused, concentrated, whatever, right? That's happening in the mind. And the fourth is dharmas. Dharmas is phenomena, probably best translated with the Satipatthana. So investigating phenomena, but with respect to the Buddha's dharma. So investigating dharmas with respect to the dharma. And all of those things that we're investigating, you know, most of them are mind. Some of them, however, are body. So yeah, the Satipatthana practices are the insight practices to do with your supremely concentrated mind. This is why we do the jhanas. There's another side effect besides indistractability, and that is that these states are so one-pointed, so focused, that there's nothing going on but the jhana. When you're in the third jhana, you are contented, and all that you know is contentment. This has a tendency to make your normal ego construction get quiet. I'm assuming all of you know that you construct your ego out of your thoughts and your emotions. You've probably come across that. That's the anatta teaching. There's no little guy sitting behind your eyeballs looking out, pulling the levers to make your arm go up and down or making your mouth wobble so you can talk or anything. That's a thing we make up, but we make it up very, very vociferously. And once you're really concentrated, you don't have any bandwidth left over to make it up. And so now your ego is gone, sat in the corner and it shut up. So when you start your insight practice, you're looking at the world from a less egocentric perspective, which is going to give you a more accurate picture than way we normally look at it. Normally, our approach to the world is, can I eat that or will that eat me? Well, we get a little more sophisticated, but it's, is this something I want to get? Is this something I need to push away or something I can ignore? It's all about me. I'm going to get it. I'm going to push it away. I'm going to ignore it. If you are looking at the world from a less egocentric perspective, you have a much better chance of seeing what's going on. Right? And so the jhana practice quiets your ego construction and gives you a supremely indistractable mind. So when you start whatever insight practice you're going to do, it's going to be much more effective. That's one thing to do after, say, the fourth jhana. But in some of the suttas, some of the Buddha's discourses, he talks about four additional states. These are the four immaterial states. In the suttas, it talks about four jhanas and four immaterial states. Sometimes they're put together. And so in the later Abhidhamma and commentaries, they just, instead of saying the four jhanas and the four immaterial states, they just say the eight jhanas. And I think that's a wise way to talk about it, because these are a continuum of sorts. So instead of going to your insight practice after the fourth jhana, you could move towards the fifth jhana. The fifth jhana is called the experience of limitless space. You often see it translated as the realm of infinite space. Realm is an okay translation. That's what the Pali word means. But I think a better translation would be experience. So you have an experience of infinite space or limitless space. You get there by finding something that you can imagine expanding without limit. With a very concentrated mind, you can stay focused on that. And if you do it well enough, eventually a vast empty space appears in front of you. It's like you go next door to the Grand Canyon and you walk up to the edge and there's a big space in front of you, only this time there's no bottom and there's no other side. It's that big a space, right? If you're visual, you see it. If you're not particularly visual, you'll sense it, that there's this huge space. You're not tapping into an ontologically existent infinite space out there. You're having experience and you're interpreting it. I'm experiencing an infinite space, okay? The sense of observer is getting smaller and smaller through each of the jhanas. There is a point of observation in each of them, but it gets smaller and smaller until now you don't even notice the observer. There's just this big space. And it's only really in retrospect that you realize, oh yeah, there was a point of observation of this space. The sixth jhana is the experience of limitless consciousness, or the realm of infinite consciousness. The trick for moving to that one is to realize that you can't be aware of a limitless space with a limited consciousness. So can you shift your attention from your awareness of the space to your awareness of your awareness? Can you become conscious of your consciousness? If you can do that, it feels like you absorb into the space and now your mind is as big as the space was and you have a limitless consciousness. Again, you're not tapping into some ontologically existent universal consciousness or anything. You're just having the experience and that's how you're interpreting it. Okay? I seriously doubt that you can find an infinite consciousness out there that's independent of all the other little consciousnesses running around on this little sphere and maybe some other spheres in this universe. Okay, it's something that we create, co-create. It's like the internet. Where's the internet? I mean, where is it? We talk about the internet. Where's the internet? Is it inside your computer? Is it inside Mr. Google's computer? Does it belong to that guy that's running Facebook? I hope not. Where is it? Well, obviously it's not anywhere. It's a collection of communication protocols and a bunch of computers talking using those communication protocols. This is what universal consciousness is. It's all of us talking to each other. It's not independent of us, and it's not something magical outside of us either. So when you tap into the sixth jhana, you're tapping into an experience that seems like you have an unlimited consciousness, but it's just a really good concentration state. From there, you can move to the seventh jhana, the experience of nothingness or no thingness. The trick for moving there is to notice what the content of the consciousness is. And after you've been there a while, the sense of space has disappeared and there's just the consciousness and it doesn't really seem to have any content. There's nothing there. Can you put your attention on the nothing, the no thingness? People who stumble into this state unprepared often, well, think they've fallen into the void and freak out. I know this because I've had students come on retreat with me and say, can I tell you about something that happened to me? And they describe what I call the seventh jhana, this vast, empty nothingness. And they go, sounds like the seventh jhana. Well, what happened? Oh, I went running to the teacher and they told me to get something to eat and take a shower and don't meditate for a while. You know, it sounded to me like the seventh jhana. I think you've been fine. So they learn the jhanas. And they get up to six and I say, oh yeah, you got that. Now here's the instruction for seven. And they're like, I don't want to go back there. That was scary. It's like, no, it'll be fine. So I give them the instructions. They go away. They come back. Yeah, that's right where I was. Only this time it wasn't scary. The only reason it was frightening because you didn't know what was happening, right? The fear itself, right? Once you know what's happening, it's wonderful. There's nothing there to bother you. It's a great place to hang out. To get there, put your attention on the nothingness of the sixth jhana, the infinite consciousness, and see if it'll stabilize into a state where there's nothing, just no thing. If you're visual, it'll be dark, black, deep purple, dark blue, something like that. It may show up as static. You know, on the old TV, you turned it to where there wasn't a channel, you got black and white static. Imagine black and black static. Seventh jhana for some people shows up like that. Other people, it's just the void. But it's a great place to hang out because there's nothing can bother you and your mind is supremely concentrated. And then the eighth jhana, the experience of neither perception or non-perception. Perception is a translation of the Pali word sanya. It's our ability to conceptualize things. Like, can everybody see the bird and the flowers? You see the bird and the flowers? Can you see it? Yeah, nod your head if you see it. Yeah, there's no bird or flowers. It's just colored shapes. The bird and flowers are in your mind. You see the colored shapes and you conceptualize it. Oh, this is a bird and those are flowers. No, it's just colored shapes. You're conceptualizing bird and flowers. This is sanya, perception, is the way it's usually translated. Although I want to translate it as conceptualization. It's how you identify things. It's how you name things. One of my favorite things is to be walking in the woods and I see something and I don't know what I'm looking at. And I can watch my mind churn for 5 or 10 seconds till I finally figure out, oh, it's mushrooms on a stump or whatever it is. But we want to identify things. And once we do, I can't unsee the mushrooms on a stump. It's locked in. When I look there, that's what I see, even though for that 5 seconds, it was completely unknown to me. So the eighth jhana is a state where, well, there's no conceptualizing and no not conceptualizing, no identifying nor not identifying. I don't guess that really explains it very well. It's a state that has no characteristics by which you can describe it, yet you know you're in a state that has no characteristics by which you can describe it, and you can focus on being in that state and stay there. Yeah, I know that doesn't describe it either. The good news is if you get really good at 7, it's actually fairly easy to find 8. But you got to get good at 7 first. And before that, yeah, you got to get good at the ones that come before it. But these are the 8 jhanas. These are states of mind that will temporarily suppress your ego creation and increase your indistractability to such an extent that when you start doing an insight practice, no matter what the insight practice is, it's going to be more effective. I didn't learn the 8 jhanas until I'd been practicing for 6 years. And the amount of insights I'd gotten in those 6 years, I compared to getting behind the wheel of a car. And there's this lever here, and if I push it up, it blinks over here. And if I pull it down, it blinks over there. That's 6 years of insight practice. When I started doing insight practice post-jhana, I backed the car out of the parking lot and drove around the block. I hadn't been on the freeway yet, but I gained enough insight. This was a 5.5-week retreat. When I came back from it, my friends could see that I was different. It really turbocharges your investigation of reality. And so what the Buddha is teaching is sila, samadhi, panya, morality, concentration, wisdom. Basically, clean up your act, keep the precepts, learn to concentrate your mind, use your concentrated mind to investigate the nature of reality and gain wisdom as to how reality actually works. So there's a brief introduction to the jhanas. I'm guessing there might be a few questions along the way. So if you've got a question, raise your hand. The reactions button at the bottom of the screen, if you click that, you see raise hand. You click that, your hand goes up and I'll know you have a question. David, you got to unmute yourself too.
Yes, there we go. Right. Thank you. What was the third word? This is just a real brief question. Sila, samadhi, and then
panya.
What?
Panya.
Panya.
P-A-N-N-A with tildes over the ends, and it translates as wisdom.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Other questions? Hildegard.
Have you experienced the void, the seventh stage, frequently as you're as you're doing concentration meditation, I guess? Or you definitely know when you're there, I'm sure.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Frequently. So when I'm on retreat, the jhanas are pretty accessible. At home, sometimes they're there. Sometimes there have been times I sit down to meditate for an hour and I only get distracted one time. And that distraction lasted the whole hour. You might have had a meditation like that. You know, sometimes it's just like that. It depends on what's going on in my life, whether I can generate access concentration or not. If I can generate access concentration, I can get to the first, second, third jhana pretty much every time. Fourth jhana, most of the time. Beyond that, at home is difficult. It's possible, but it doesn't happen all that much. I would like it to happen more frequently, but So frequently, it happens frequently on retreat, but I wouldn't say it happens frequently when I'm at home. And I spend a lot more time at home than I do on retreat. But I've spent a lot of time there. I found it to be a very wonderful place to hang out. Not so much while I'm there, because when I'm there's nothing going on. It's quiet, it's restful, it's peaceful, nothing to disturb me. But when I come out of it, my mind is very, very indistractable. And it's a great place to start doing insight practice from. And I've had some very deep insights coming out of that and doing insight practice.
Wow. This everything you just said requires a lot of processing, I would say.
Well, mostly it requires a lot of practice. These states are not a big deal. You know, like I drive up to the toll taker on the San Francisco Bay Bridge, and he'll let me across for just $5 when I tell him I can do all eight jhanas. Of course, he'll let me across for $5 if I don't tell him I can do all eight jhanas. You know, eight jhanas and a buck will get you a cup of coffee, provided you go to someplace cheap. They're a useful deal, and you can learn to do this. It's a skill. You know, I mean, we all have skills that we've learned. I was a computer programmer, so I was, being paid lots of money to concentrate. Well, I've been concentrating since kindergarten. Right. And so now I found a use for that concentration on the spiritual path. And I learned these states, and then I do my insight practice, and the insights are transformative. So, it's possible to learn these. Unfortunately, it pretty much requires going on a retreat for most people, like a 10-day or longer retreat, just to have a chance to get quiet enough. Mm-hmm. I remember teaching in Santa Fe early on in my career, and we're halfway through this retreat and nobody's learned any jhanas. What am I doing wrong? You know, it's day five. And then the next day, everybody starts, well, not everybody, but the jhanas start happening to people. It just takes 4 or 5 days for people to get that settled so that they can get the deep concentration necessary. But it's doable. I wouldn't be teaching if it wasn't doable, but there's no guarantee that if you go on a retreat that it's going to happen for you. You just pays your money and takes your chances, as they say. AIMC meeting room. So I don't know your name.
Oh yeah, Steve. Yeah, I forgot to change my name. Hi. Wonderful summary, just terrific. Having read a couple books, probably read more than practiced, it was wonderful. But can you talk a little bit about helpful attitudes as you start practicing the jhanas versus unhelpful type of attitudes or approaches? Or can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So at the start of every retreat I teach, I give two warnings. The first warning is if you start fooling with concentration and you have any unresolved psychological issues, they might show up. Now, this is New Mexico, it's not California, so I'm assuming none of you have any unresolved psychological issues, so not going to be a problem. But just on the off chance, yeah, and you don't even have to get jhanically concentrated, just get concentrated, and the energy you use to keep unresolved stuff at bay, yeah, it's not going that way, it's going into your concentration, and stuff can show up. This is not a bad thing, it's not a pleasant thing. So having an attitude of, yeah, I can deal with whatever shows up is helpful. Because if it shows up, at least you can deal with it. If it's hidden away down there, who knows what it's doing underneath. So having this willingness to, yeah, be open to whatever comes along is really important. The second warning is if you have any expectations, you're in trouble. The worst thing you can bring on a retreat is expectations. All that you can really expect is going to be different than what you expect. But me saying don't have expectations doesn't make your expectations go away. So on a retreat, I'll lay out the instructions in as best detail as I can. And it's like, well, it's like the instructions for, say, I was going to drive from Oakland, California, where I live, to Albuquerque, right? And you give me the instruction. It says, go down the street you live on. When you get to the bottom of the street at the stop sign, you take a right. When you go under the freeway, you take a left. You get on the freeway, you look for this exit. You know, really detailed instructions. This is before GPS, right? If I start looking for Albuquerque as I'm driving down my street, that's not going to work well. I'm liable to have an accident if I'm looking for Albuquerque when I come onto the freeway as opposed to paying attention to merging with the traffic, right? When I give you the instructions for the jhanas, the idea is that you know where you are and what you're supposed to do next, just like if you're following instructions to drive from Oakland to Albuquerque. I'm on Highway 24. What I do next is I look for this exit and get on 680 and then, you know, whatever, right? So paying attention to what's happening and what you're supposed to be doing and what the landmark is for when you do something else, rather than, am I there yet? Am I at the jhana? Is the jhana right there? I mean, it's like sitting in the back seat going, Daddy, are we there yet? Right? Don't do that. So a willingness to look deeply at whatever shows up, patience to just follow the instructions and see what happens. And then, yeah, a good understanding of the instructions so you know what to do. If you take a left turn when you should have taken a right turn, it's not going to work real well. Same thing with the instructions. If you know what you're supposed to do. For this, I have interviews. When I teach you a retreat, I want to see everybody three times in a 11-day retreat. And so you come in and you tell me what you're doing, and I say, yeah, that's good. When you get to this thing, do this a little differently, or maybe you need a different insight, access method, or, you know, it's all sorts of possibilities for the interview, or maybe your stuff has come up. So the attitude to have is one of being curious, being really willing to work diligently, not afraid of what you're going to encounter, and the patience to just hang in there and follow the instructions rather than go looking for some sort of result.
Thank you.
Yes. Mary. You're still muted. There we go.
There we go. Yeah, so it's beautiful. And I've had, even without knowing about the jhanas, I've had some experiences that have happened that I do have a sense. Hold on, I'm just seeing myself, and I don't want to see myself here. Let me go back to gallery. There we go. And so I've had some very profound experiences, and you know, I don't know, maybe they're jhanas, maybe not. What I wonder is, how do I say this? How does this translate into coming back into life? I have a sense, and I've talked to other people too, it can get a little like, oh, I want this. And it's almost an addictive kind of thing, like a drug, you know? And
yeah,
that hasn't been my experience, but how does this come back into living daily? I'm with my husband. We have an argument. You know what, or my kids, or the war, or you know, how, what's your experience, because you're very experienced in this, it would be helpful to know how you feel this really comes into your life, translates into your life, maybe that's
right. Yeah, people stumbled into these states all the time. I stumbled into the first jhana on my second retreat. I didn't know it was a jhana. They didn't tell me it was a jhana because they didn't know that was what was happening to me and so forth. But yeah, so I'm not at all surprised that you've found this somewhat familiar. So what do you do with it? Well, what you do with it is you use the state to investigate reality. In other words, you're in this state. It's a really cool state. Can you let it go and now do your insight practice? That's the key thing. I have been transformed by my meditation practice, no doubt about it. But it wasn't so much these jhanic states that transformed me as the insights I got by doing insight practice in the post-jhanic state of mind. So in other words, I run up to the fourth jhana, and then I step out and start doing my insight practice. Say it's a body scan. I just start doing a body scan. Fourth jhana fades away. That's fine. It's like sharpening a knife. Yeah, when you sharpen it, okay, it's sharp. You now can cut, and it gets dull again. So you sharpen it again. It gets dull at the end of the sitting. I do some walking meditation, come back, sit again, get it sharp, do another insight practice. So mostly I've been transformed by the insights I've gotten while doing this practice, rather than the jhanas in and of themselves. But one thing I can say, I've done meditation for science a number of times, and we have pictures of my brain on jhanas. One thing that we notice is that the reward center in the center of the brain becomes very active. Well, we don't know about first jhana because the muscle tension of the PT kind of messes up the data. But for second jhana, as the neuroscientist said, my reward center was on overdrive. Okay, so that's nice. Second jhana is still going. Third jhana is still going. Fourth jhana, even though it feels subjectively neutral, equanimous, it's still going. Furthermore, they can see that the left prefrontal cortex is much more active in the jhanas than the right prefrontal cortex. The right prefrontal cortex is associated with aversive emotions, unpleasant emotions, disturbing emotions. The left prefrontal cortex is associated with positive emotions, right? So they have also discovered in neuroscience that any state of mind that you hang in out in repeatedly tends to become more of your emotional set point. So if you're spending a lot of time in, you know, left side positive mind states rather than in negative mind states, you will have a tendency over time to move your emotional set point to more positive. So yeah, I'm kind of a happy, positive guy. That was there before I started practice because I had a happy childhood, so I got a leg up on it. But I think it's better than it used to be. I think when things go wrong, I don't freak out as badly as I used to. I think that's the best thing. And so you mentioned the war. Yeah, I mean, this is a horrible thing that's happening. But I can step into an equanimous place to read what's going on and not be so freaked out by all the terrible tragedies that are happening on a daily basis over there. And the same thing with, yeah, any number of other unpleasantnesses in the world these days. It's possible for me, I just have a more of a natural tendency to step into an equanimous state when I'm reading or seeing stuff about it. But when it happens to me personally, yeah, my equanimity may not be there as strongly as if I'm reading about it, but I don't tend to freak out as badly as I used to. I think back before I started practice and yeah, had this terrible thing happen, screwed up my knees. Oh yeah, I was in a really bad, depressed mood. But later, after years of practice, when I had shoulder problems, I didn't fall into the same funk. You know, it's just like, again, a medical thing. This one was going to require surgery, but I just didn't get as freaked out. But I'm going to put that down primarily to the insights that I got doing insight practice post jhana, rather than the time I spent hanging out in the jhanas.
That's very helpful. Yeah. Thank you.
Right. All right. Alice is the last one because I see we're running out of time. So, Alice.
So this may peripherally be a reflection of jhanas, but and the contrast between jhana states and other aspects of one's psyche. But one thing I have noticed is that the more accessible samadhi has been, and the easier it has been for me to be in concentrated states in my waking life, in meditation, and have a generally more equanimity in my waking life, I find that in my sleeping life, all of those aspects of my psyche that, of course, I didn't have such a happy childhood, represent historical experience in metaphorical form. They come out. It's like Night on Bald Mountain, if you've ever seen Fantasia.
Yes.
And so so then I sometimes they wake it awakens me, and I'm like, whoa. But and I wonder if you've what you may know about that phenomenon.
I do know that on retreat, people have very amazing dreams. I've had very amazing dreams on retreat. When I've been on retreat, when I'm teaching a retreat, I have much more vivid and amazing dreams than I do at home. Some of them are very disturbing, both when I'm a student and a teacher. But I now have less nightmares than I used to have. Now, I'm not sure whether that's due to the practices, the change begin to happen. It really happened when I took a 3-year trip around the world. I had to encounter a lot of stuff there. And after that trip, the nightmares were less. They still happen occasionally. But yeah, when we're dreaming, it's stuff under there that hasn't really been seen that's coming up. And so if you're finding that you're having a lot of unpleasant dreams, if you can find a Jungian therapist, because they're the people that know the most about working with dreams, and find somebody to talk with about that and see if they can have any ideas about, one, how to interpret what's coming up in a way that helps you examine what's underneath it, and also how to examine stuff so that it's less likely to come up in a disturbing dream?
Well, you know, it's not as though you're talking to someone who knows a lot about that, but it's not as though it's disturbing to me. I don't mind having these dreams, but it's an interesting, you know, because I think I understand what they represent. But it's interesting that it comes, that it has been more present. It has occurred more often. It's more vivid, I think, than it used to be.
Right.
Because I'm not, it seems to me, I mean, the way I explain it to myself is that because I don't behave that way in my everyday waking life as much, it's not as though one's history is gone. It's still there and comes to attention of its own accord without asking permission.
Yes. And when, like I said, with the concentration, stuff comes up. And so by working more concentration, whatever was under there is going to be closer to the surface and has more of a tendency to show up. And so if it doesn't show up in your ordinary consciousness, then it may run off to a dream to show up. So, yeah, this makes total sense.
Right, right. Okay, thank you. Good.
Sure. All right. Well, we've already run over time, but we really should end with metta. So I'm going to do a really quick metta. So put your attention on your breath for just a moment here. So do you like to be happy? I mean, if you're happy, is that a good thing? You appreciate being happy? Can you get in touch with how nice it is to be happy? It's excellent being happy. May you be happy. You like it when your friends are happy? Like you go see your friend and your friend's happy, is that a good thing? What if you go to hang out with a bunch of friends and they're all happy? I mean, even if you're in a grumpy mood, if they're all happy, they can pull you back up. That's nice. What if all of your friends were happy? Wouldn't that be great? May all of our friends be happy. May our families be happy. Yeah, if all the family drama went away because everybody was happy, wouldn't that be neat? Yeah, may our families be happy. What if all your acquaintances were happy? All the neighbors are happy. All your coworkers are happy. All the people you encounter in a store, all the customers, the clerks, they're all happy. Oh, that'd be nice. I'd like that for sure. What if the difficult people in your life had wholesome sources of happiness? Not the stuff that makes them difficult, but they had wholesome sources of happiness. Maybe they wouldn't be so difficult. You can even appreciate it if the difficult people find wholesome sources of happiness. What if all of us were happy? Hey, that'd be pretty cool. I'd like that. What if everybody on this planet was happy? That's where I want to live. I want to live on a planet where everybody's happy. Wouldn't that be cool? May all beings everywhere be happy. So thank you. They say that teaching the Dhamma is a good way to make merit. May any merit from this evening be for the benefit and liberation of all beings everywhere. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed sharing this evening with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.